From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the 1992 presidential campaign, network news lost control of the story to talk shows and to cable and local news shows. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with LA Times media and political correspondent Tom Rosensteel. During the campaign, he was given behind-the-scenes access to ABC News. His new book about the network's coverage of the campaign is Strange Bedfellows. Also today, we talk with a former director of White House Media Relations. Kristen Clark Taylor was the first African-American woman to serve in that position. She worked for the Bush administration. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the first Daxophone opera. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A U.S. attack jet fired on an anti-aircraft radar station in southern Iraq today after Iraqi radar locked on to one of the two American jets in the area. Baghdad says one soldier was wounded in the attack. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
The two U.S. aircraft were flying a routine mission over the southern no-fly zone of Iraq. Shortly after 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, radar illuminated one of the aircraft, indicating the plane could be in danger of attack. The pilot of the Air Force F-4G attack jet fixed on the radar and fired a HARM missile at the AAA radar site. A HARM missile is a high-speed anti-radiation missile used to destroy ground radar systems. There is no assessment of damage to the radar site as yet. Both U.S. attack jets returned safely to base in the Persian Gulf area. Pentagon spokesman Captain Michael Doubleday was asked whether the incident was connected to the current tensions with Iraq. Doubleday said it would be premature to attach any particular significance to this event, since this has happened in the past when the Iraqis were testing their radar. I'm Martha Raddatz, reporting.
Haitian General Raoul Cedras said today he wants a face-to-face meeting with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the man he ousted almost 2 years ago. Cedras and Aristide have been negotiating through a UN mediator, Dante Caputo, who's been shuttling between them. Diplomats told the Reuters news agency that Cedras has said that he's willing to step down as long as the Haitian military high command remains in place and the army is not disbanded. One of the U.S. Senate's liberal voices announced today he won't run for re-election next year. Ohio Democrat Howard Metzenbaum says he's retiring to spend more time with his wife and family. Metzenbaum's announcement has been anticipated in his home state. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports several candidates are lining up to try to replace him.
You have my word on it. That's the tagline that attorney Joel Hyatt is famous for in TV ads for his chain of storefront law offices for the middle class. And Hyatt hopes to use the high name ID the commercials have bought to win next year's Senate election. He is Metzenbaum's son-in-law, but he could face competition for the party nomination from another well-known Democrat, former Governor Richard Celeste. Like Hyatt, he's considered a great speaker and campaigner. On the Republican side, another possible contested primary, Lieutenant Governor Mike DeWine, who spent 8 years in Congress, is trying to get back to Washington. He ran unsuccessfully for John Glenn's Senate seat last year. DeWine is being challenged for the party nomination by State Senator Gene Watts. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Dow Industrials lost 11 points today. This is NPR News. The Air Force is denying claims that top military officials lied to Congress about the ability of the B-1B bomber to evade radar. General John Lowe told a Senate Armed Services panel today that there were two sets of data on the bomber's vulnerability to radar, and they may have been confused by investigators. The General Accounting Office says that the military provided false data to the agency during a review of strategic forces. Today in Detroit, jurors in the Malice Green murder trial heard an account of how the altercation began between Green, a black man, and the two white police officers who were accused of beating him to death. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
Malice Green's friend, Ralph Fletcher, testified that on a night last November, Green was sitting in the passenger side of his car looking for the driver's license two officers had asked him for. Fletcher says Officer Walter Budson saw Green reach for the floor of the car, and Budson asked Green to open his clenched hand.
Did Malice Green make any response?
Never said a word.
What happened then?
He got in the car with Malice and started hitting him on his right hand.
Fletcher says Budson's partner, Larry Nevers, went to the driver's side of the car and began hitting Green in the head. According to the testimony, both officers were hitting Green with heavy police flashlights. Green died within an hour. Both officers are now charged with second-degree murder, and a third is charged with assault. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
President Clinton is reportedly planning to name a Washington antitrust lawyer to head the Federal Communications Commission. The Associated Press quoted a commission source as saying the president will nominate Reed Hunt, a former high school classmate of Vice President Al Gore. The choice of Hunt, who's known as an antitrust rather than a communications lawyer, may be a response to the trend toward mergers among the television, telephone, and computer companies the commission regulates. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If one of America's favorite sports is criticizing politicians, another is criticizing how the media covers politicians. My guest Tom Rosenstiel has been keeping score on both fronts. He's the media and political correspondent for the LA Times. During the 1992 presidential campaign, he wanted to see how the media shaped the race. He focused on ABC News, where he was given behind-the-scenes access to story meetings, editing bays, and other editorial discussions. Rosenstiel's new book is called Strange Bedfellows, How Television and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. He says that network TV has lost some of its power to cable and, more surprisingly, to local affiliates.
That happened over the last decade, and one of the seminal events that is mostly unknown in television and in American culture was that when CNN came along, they started selling their footage to local affiliates all across the country. And what that did is it revolutionized, in many ways, the dissemination of information in the United States, because before that, the networks essentially had a monopoly over national news on television. A CBS affiliate couldn't get CBS footage of events from around the world or around the country until after they had appeared on the CBS Evening News, and that was true at all three networks. CNN broke that monopoly, and in a sense, shortly thereafter, forced the three commercial networks to begin selling their footage in advance of their own newscasts to their affiliates to make it available so that suddenly local news all around the country by the mid-'80s was capable of providing all the national news that people were going to see that once belonged exclusively to the networks.
Candidate Clinton helped the local TV stations, too, by doing satellite press conferences with local anchors and local reporters. Do candidates and politicians in general sometimes prefer talking to local affiliates rather than the network people?
A presidential election should be split into two parts. First, there is the primary section, which is, in a sense, a series of local campaigns. And in those campaigns, nothing works like local television or local radio, because you can address local concerns, you can make it relevant to the community, generally there is a presumption on the part of politicians that local anchormen, while they may be bright and may be good newsmen and women, are not as familiar with the national issues that a candidate is talking about. So the candidate has greater control. In other words, he can do a better snow job. There is also a presumption which the Clinton campaign and the Bush campaign came to firmly believe in 1992, which is that audiences identify now more with their local media than they do with the national press. They view the national media and national networks, national newspapers, as part of that elite establishment from which citizens feel alienated in general. But the local newsman, my local, you know, Bill Bonds in Detroit, he's a guy I trust, and, you know, he's the guy who gives me my news. Well, you don't feel that Peter Jennings giving you your news, that he's your newsman. So the greater local identification that audiences have with local news people is something that the candidates now, not just the two candidates in 92, but across the board, feel it works tremendously to their advantage. Not only do they have more control over these guys, but audiences believe these guys more.
Another part of the story that took away some of the power from network TV was radio. You found, for instance, that candidate Clinton's press staff developed an 800 number for radio sound bites.
They had a system, and it all developed by accident. They basically started out with a college intern in New Hampshire named Richard Strauss, who decided to take a leave of absence from UCLA and join the Clinton campaign. And he started trailing Clinton around with his portable tape player and found that local radio stations around New Hampshire were delighted to have what we call actualities, little sound bites from Clinton's appearances that day. By the fall, when the November election was getting close, the Clinton campaign had developed a computer switching system that they had in Little Rock by which any local radio station around the country could call in and a computer would answer and say, "Hello, this is the Clinton hotline. If you want an actuality from Bill Clinton, press 1. If you want an actuality from Al Gore, press 2. If you want Hillary Clinton, press 3. If you'd like something for Hispanic stations, press 4. If you want something for black stations, press 5. And if you want something for college stations, press 6. And then whatever number you press, they had sound bites from those days' events that were tailored to those markets. And no human hand was involved in that switching process. In the Clinton campaign, it was all computerized.
It's a pretty good definition of managing the news.
Or at least supplying the demand.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Rosensteel, author of the new book Strange Bedfellows, How TV and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. He's a media and political correspondent for the L.A. Times. Something interesting you reported on was that candidate Clinton sought the advice of journalists during the campaign. A lot of journalists worried that this could compromise them by making them insiders instead of outsiders watching what was happening. What kind of advice did Clinton seek from journalists, and what kinds of journalists did he seek out?
Well, in the early stages of the campaign, in the fall of 1991, something takes place now that might best be called the invisible primary. And this is the period of time in which the candidates are scrambling to be defined as serious, to be defined as people who have a real chance of winning the nomination. And who decides who is who and who sorts out the race in this invisible primary is no longer the parties, which aren't really strong enough to have party bosses and to sort out the candidates. To a large degree, it is the media. And Bill Clinton understood that, and what he did was that he would seek out reporters and seek their advice, ask them about theories they had about politics, and he would seek out the most influential reporters at major magazines or journals of opinion around the country, Increasingly, journalists find themselves in the role in general now of being interested not just in reporting the news, but in really trying to shape the direction of political parties or trying to come up with ideas about how the direction of policy. So you had people like E.J. Dionne, who's a reporter at the Washington Post, who'd written a book called Why People Hate Politics. That was a history of the parties of the last 25 years and a prescription for where the two parties should be headed. Well, Clinton would go so far as to talk about the book on the stump and refer to my good friend E.J. Dionne. While Dionne was down there in the pit with the rest of the reporters taking notes supposedly covering the event. There were others. Joe Klein, who was an influential reporter at New York Magazine who then went to Newsweek. Has written powerfully about the failure of the Great Society and some of the social programs of the Democratic Party in the 60s and the direction that the Democratic Party should go. And Clinton sought his advice out interviews that these reporters would do, they told me, would quickly sort of evolve into a dialogue in which they realized that the Clinton was trying to sort of seduce them and flatter them by seeking their ideas. One reporter, a friend of mine at the LA Times named Ron Brownstein, called it the invisible circle of complicity, in which the candidate would call you up after a story had run to talk more about your ideas about things. It was a way for Clinton to both find out where the press was headed to gather information, but also a way to seduce the press into thinking, this guy, Bill Clinton, he's a smart guy.
Did some of the journalists say no?
Some of the journalists, I'm told by Clinton aides, were much more formal about this process than others. E.J. Dionne, for instance, when he was interviewing Clinton, those were much more formal interviews. With Joe Klein at New York Magazine, it was a fuzzier kind of process. With Michael Kremer at Time Magazine, I'm told, these were more like dialogues than interviews. Sidney Blumenthal at The New Republic, now at The New Yorker, who wrote an influential cover piece about Clinton at a pivotal time in the early days of the campaign, even would describe himself as an informal advisor to the Clinton camp, which, as one Clinton advisor said to me later, that was generous.
My guest is Tom Rosenstiel, media and political correspondent for the LA Times and author of the new book, Strange Bedfellows, How TV and the Presidential Candidates Changed American Politics in 1992. Tom, let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Rosenstiel, author of the new book Strange Bedfellows, about how TV covered the 1992 presidential campaign. When the Jennifer Flowers story broke during the primaries, there was obviously a lot of debate in the media about whether this was a legitimate story or just a tabloid story, and, you know, whether it should be covered or not. What kinds of editorial discussions did you hear behind the scenes at ABC on that subject?
Well, when the Jennifer Flowers story broke, it happened this way. It first broke in something called the Star, which is a supermarket tabloid. And an ABC off-air researcher got a hold of this story. It was faxed to him by the news desk at ABC in New York. He was traveling with Clinton in New Hampshire, and he corralled Clinton in a Manchester hotel lobby and showed him the story and said, we're going to ask you about this later. So Clinton was then on notice that this thing had appeared and that the national press, even though it was just a supermarket tabloid, had gotten a hold of it. This off-air researcher, whose name is Mark Halperin, then rode in a van with other reporters to Clinton's next event, which was at a brush factory upstate New Hampshire. And in that van, he showed them the supermarket tabloid story. So he had shared this story with them and given it a kind of momentum. And then inside the brush factory, which was in the foyer of the brush factory, which was about an 8x12 sized room, all these reporters then were sort of loaded for bear to ask Clinton about this thing, in part because ABC had distributed it. Clinton arrives at the brush factory, and the lights go on. You know, the camera is about 8 inches from his face, and he's asked, you know, who's the woman? What is it true? You know, a question after question before he's able to answer one question, the next question is coming at him. And this exchange, in fact, I sort of just go through it verbatim in the book because it's terrifying to read. And the tape comes back to New York via satellite, and Jim Wooten, the ABC correspondent, gets on a cell phone in his car, a cellular phone, and starts describing what happened and that the tape is on its way. And on the rim at ABC in New York, they start having a debate. Is adultery an issue? Should we deal with a man's private life? Is it relevant to his public character? Has this story been substantiated or has it not? And this was, you know, like a college seminar. There were people on all sides, and there were Peter Jennings, chief political researcher, and a woman named Nancy Gabriner says, you know, let's not do this. This is wrong. It doesn't matter. It's none of our business. It doesn't say anything about public character. And Jeff Greenfield, a correspondent for Nightline and for ABC's World News Tonight, who himself was ambivalent about this, is arguing, look, the adultery is the, you know, is one of the Ten Commandments. Is it not relevant if someone is breaking one of the, you know, is committing a cardinal sin? Who are we to decide that it's not relevant for our audience? And they basically didn't know what to do. And what they ended up deciding that first night was, let's pass. Let's not deal with the Jennifer Flowers story. Now, the same decision was made at all three networks that first night. It was a Thursday. And the producers of those programs went home that night. And at 11 o'clock at night, they turned on their local late news, and the Jennifer Flowers story was leading the newscast in local broadcasts all across the country. And they recognized that by the next morning, they were losing control of the story. The networks and the New York Times and the great media institutions in the country no longer had the power to control the news agenda or even to set the news standards for the rest of the country.
Some interesting stories about Perot. It seems like ABC wasn't very interested, really, in covering him at the beginning. I mean, you tell a story about how Perot was on the Brinkley Show one Sunday morning, mm-hmm. and everybody on the show found him completely incoherent. They didn't want to have him on again. And then there was a behind-the-scenes meeting mm-hmm. with Jennings and other news guys and executives at ABC. Tell us what happened at that meeting.
This was a meeting at Rune Arledge's house where they were discovering that this campaign had gone off in a direction that they just had not prepared for. Stepping back for a moment, Perot appeared on Larry King on February 20th, 2 days after the New Hampshire primary. And almost 2 months went by before the mainstream media, anywhere in the mainstream media, did a story about Perot of any magnitude. By the time that the mainstream media began to recognize Perot, he was already at 20% in the polls. And that had happened through talk radio and interactive media like Larry King. Through the subterranean of new media, shows you know that Peter Jennings and Rune Arledge and the rest of the people at ABC had never heard of. So this meeting in late May at Arledge's house was to take stock of the fact that this campaign had sort of spiraled out of their, not only out of their reach, but out of their understanding. And Rune Arledge in particular argues that they should do, to catch up, they should do an hour-long special examining who Perot is and giving his biography. And then afterwards, they should invite Perot on for a lengthy live town hall for Perot to interact with a live studio audience and do his thing on ABC for the rest of the nation. The plans go into effect to do this, and in the meantime, the investigative team at ABC starts gearing up to look into Perot, and a reporter is assigned to cover Perot. And what happened in the weeks that followed revealed an enormous amount about Ross Perot that was terrifying and fascinating to the people at ABC, and none of it ever got on the air, virtually.
What did Perot say behind the scenes that you think he might not have wanted to say had the cameras been on?
Well, for one thing, as they were leading up to this hour-long special, Perot started calling the people at ABC, desperately paranoid about the fact that the live studio audience at this town hall might be a stacked deck, that they might be Republican plants from what he called the Republican hit attack machine, and that ABC was out to destroy Perot for the sake of its own ratings. And he said that he'd been warned by the beautiful people in New York that this is what was going to happen. And when the people at ABC said to him, you know, what are you talking about? Who are the beautiful people in New York? You know, what do you mean? He said, well, maybe it's just been leaked to me by the Republican hit machine that this is going to happen because they're trying to prey on my mind. You know, that's what they do. They prey on your mind, and it's working. And the people at ABC, and these are private conversations, were like appalled. What the executive producer of that particular program had been someone who was interested in Perot and perhaps, you know, voting for Perot. But this 25-minute conversation with him, with Perot, put off this executive that he lost all interest in Perot as a potential political figure.
Did anyone at NBC really feel that it was their job to expose Perot for being, you know, muddle-headed and paranoid, the kinds of behavior he was exhibiting behind the scenes to them?
Well, one of the points that I make in the book, or try to make, is that one role that the press plays that's very important is that the reporters out on the campaign trail are close to a candidate. They can pick up things that you can't get through the false intimacy of television. They are there. They have personal contact. And they were beginning, through all these contacts, to come to these conclusions about Perot, and they were gearing up with a series of investigative reports that they were going to broadcast, revealing this side of Perot, the side that they saw up close, or at least as close as they were able to get, because Perot was actually not running a conventional campaign. Before they were able to get any of these stories on the air virtually, Perot dropped out. In fact, the day Perot dropped out was the day that their first investigative piece was scheduled to run. And it was scrapped because at 11 o'clock in the morning on the eve of the Democratic Convention, Perot announced that he was dropping out of the race. And so all this material, hours and weeks and months of work, was sort of just scrapped.
You think there was any coincidence there?
My guess is not.
Yeah. Is there any, like, big moral you think we take away from the 92 campaign and the coverage of it?
I do. I think that the moral is that the public is more interested in the substance of what candidates are doing and what they stand for than the press gives them credit for. The problem with the press's cynicism about the process is that we're cynical about the public and their appetite for information. And if we decide that they're not interested in anything but entertainment and we start to provide them with merely entertainment, they will turn away from journalism and turn away from public life because there are more entertaining things than reading the newspaper or watching the news.
Tom Rosenstiel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Rosenstiel is media and political correspondent for the LA Times. His new book is called Strange Bedfellows. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Kristen Clark Taylor was the first African-American woman to serve as White House Director of Media Relations. She worked for the Bush administration. Taylor was one of the few African-Americans on the White House staff. She was also in the minority in the black community as an African-American Republican. We'll discuss her new memoir, which is about being a woman of color in the White House. And chances are you've never heard or even heard of the Daxophone. Well, now's your chance. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new operetta featuring German improviser and guitarist Hans Reichel on the Daxophone, the instrument he invented. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton says a recent attack on Iraq's intelligence center made it absolutely clear that the United States will not tolerate acts of terrorism. Speaking at a news conference, Mr. Clinton indirectly accused Iraqi President Saddam Hussein of being tied to an alleged plot to kill former President Bush during a trip to Kuwait. Mr. Clinton said that according to U.S. intelligence, an operation of that magnitude is always authorized at the highest level. A letter in Iraq's Ministry of Defense newspaper has called for raids on U.S. targets and interest. Other newspapers have also been warning of more U.S. attacks. Jeremy Bowen reports for the BBC.
The letter in Al-Qaeda says the most explicit call for revenge yet from a senior official. It says that strikes at American targets and interests are the only way to deter aggression against Baghdad. Other papers warn that the United States was planning another attack because Iraq was refusing to let United Nations inspectors install surveillance cameras at strategic sites. There seems to be genuine nervousness about that. An anti-aircraft battery in Baghdad opened fire today at what turned out to be passing Iraqi aircraft, according to a local radio station controlled by Saddam Hussein's son. There was no sign of conciliation either in the official response to the American accusation that Iraq plotted to assassinate former President Bush, the reason Washington gave for the raid. In it, Iraq rejects any suggestion that it was involved.
Jeremy Boeing reporting from Baghdad. A U.S. plane in the no-fly zone over southern Iraq fired at an Iraqi missile site today after the plane had been locked onto by radar on the ground. President Clinton said that this type of firing had occurred before, and in his words, he would not read too much into it. President Clinton went before a small business association today and said that he would try to minimize the burden of his health care reform plan on small firms. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The National Federation of Independent Business is a conservative group, one that in the past has coordinated its actions carefully with Republican administrations. Today, President Clinton appealed to the group to support his health care reform plan. He said that he would try to limit the financial burden on small firms and phase in the plan's mandates. A recent Federal Reserve report said that businesses were waiting to hire new workers until they knew what costs they would bear under health reform. President Clinton didn't divulge any details, but he said he thought all employees should make some contribution to health care. Otherwise, the president said, they may get to thinking it's free and end up overutilizing the health care system. President Clinton is currently considering a number of options for health care reform, prepared for him by a task force headed by First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 11 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. National Guard troops have been called out in both Iowa and Wisconsin to help deal with flooding along the Mississippi River. Commercial traffic is stopped along some 600 miles of the river, and there is concern about more rainfall in the days ahead. At least one person has died as a result of torrential rainfall, and traffic on the river is blocked from St. Paul to St. Louis. Billions of dollars in grain headed for overseas market is carried on river barges, and a spokesman said that towboat operators are losing $1 million a day. The Social Security Administration has issued new rules that will make it much easier for people infected with the AIDS virus to qualify for federal disability benefits. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has more on the story.
Under the new guidelines, more women, poor people, and children are expected to become eligible for Social Security disability benefits. The guidelines do that by including many of the diseases that most commonly affect some of these groups, like gynecological infections and cervical cancer. The new guidelines will also include chronic infections like bacterial pneumonia and tuberculosis, which can cause severe disability. AIDS advocates say thousands of infected men, women, and children will benefit from these changes. For the past decade, the Social Security Administration had been using very restrictive medical guidelines to decide who got disability benefits and who didn't. So, 2 years ago, the HIV Law Project in New York filed a class action lawsuit charging race and sex discrimination. Today's guidelines were issued partly in response to that lawsuit, which is still pending. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
According to government officials, sales of new homes were off 21% last month. The government says that home sales were off in all parts of the country except for the West. New home sales had jumped in April to a six-year high, but the drop in May just about erased that increase. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Adaf Souif is an Egyptian writer who lives in London. Her first novel, In the Eye of the Sun, is about an Arab woman who, like Souif, lives in the West. Critic John Leonard says the story transcends geography.
Aisha Ulama, the heroine of Adaf Souif's remarkable first novel, is young, beautiful, Egyptian, and exasperating. When she should be on the barricades, she is snuggling with a sadist. When she ought to be quitting a sexless marriage, she is reading English poetry. Long after she might have been expected to take charge of her life in Cairo, Aisha is instead taking a doctorate in linguistics in the north of England, where she is always cold and generally friendless and can never stuff the vine leaves properly. Or off in Rome, where the wrong Italian makes a pass at her. Or Mooney in Beirut, before the Israelis bomb it. Or sitting around the family sepulcher in the City of the Dead, thinking about socialism, not to mention the Beatles. Aisha's whole tumultuous life is a text she can't seem to make sense of. What she does for 800 pages is deconstruct its metaphors, as if she were breaking the wings of butterflies. Imagine, if you dare, an amalgam of Marjorie Morningstar and Martha Quest and Middlemarch. Aisha's upper-middle-class Cairo girlhood is right out of Herman Wouk. Her politics on the pan-Arabic African periphery of Nasser and Sadat and the Palestinian dispossessed are right out of Doris Lessing. And just like George Eliot, she's all literature. Her college professor mother keeps telling her, this is life, not a novel. You can't sit around being in a dilemma. Things move. People change. To which Aisha responds with some heat, you keep saying, this is life, not a novel, as though somehow life were more serious. But what it really amounts to is that you don't think people should devote as much time to considering questions of character, circumstances, and motivations in real life as you would expect your students to devote to the same questions in a work of fiction. I just think that if we could manage to look at real people with the same interest, the same generous detachment that we give to a novel or play, we should understand things better. She has a point. Not that it does her any good. As if she hadn't a choice, she takes a boorish English lover, after which adultery she's knocked about by her Muslim traditionalist husband. And for no particular reason, her favorite uncle develops cancer, her best friend gets a messy divorce, Aisha is unhappy in New York, and still there is that dreary thesis to finish. Aisha's life is too much ambiguity, paradox, and metaphor, and not enough action. Except, of course, by the time we come to the ambiguous, paradoxical, and metaphorical end of the novel, we are rooting for her. We've met dozens of characters and heard hundreds of stories and learned to love Cairo as much as Dublin or St. Petersburg. We've listened to so much poetry and music and thought so much about the territorial politics of the Middle East and the sexual politics of Islam and the cultural imperialism of literature, not to mention Anna, as in Karenina, and Emma, as in Bovary, that we are ready to get on with our own lives as well as Asia's. Besides a wonderful richness, In the Eye of the Sun has a therapeutic value. By deconstructing Asia's exasperating text, Adaf Souif, under a date palm, with a lute and a tambourine, has emancipated all of us.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed In the Eye of the Sun by Adaf Souif.
¶¶
This is Fresh Air. Kristen Clark Taylor was the first African-American woman to serve as White House Director of Media Relations. She worked for the Bush administration. What made her stand out even more was that she was pregnant during most of her first year on the job. Clark has written a new memoir called The First to Speak, A Woman of Color Inside the White House. Clark grew up in Detroit. Her parents were determined to get her the best education possible and sent her to private school. She says that taught her how to be comfortable around the white establishment. When she was in 10th grade, she decided to go to public school so she could reconnect with black culture. She was on maternity leave from her position on the editorial board of USA Today when she got a call from the White House inviting her to interview for a position as assistant press secretary for Vice President George Bush. She wasn't sure she wanted the job.
I had quite a few misgivings, I think, initially. One is because I was a new mother. This was my first child, and I had not even gone back to my job at USA Today. I was a journalist at USA Today before I joined the White House staff. So it was the inability to pull away from my newborn baby. It was it represented in my life a significant career change. I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to jump from the world of journalism, which I loved, into the world of White House politics, which I was completely unsure of. And there was also the uncertainty of whether or not Bush would even be elected.
Did you have friends who thought that you were entering the enemy camp when you joined the Bush administration?
Well, I don't know. That's a little dramatic to put it like that. I think that once we got bogged down in the Willie Horton, that whole Willie Horton controversy, that's when some of the hackles started to rise, mine included, and I think that the whole issue of Willie Horton was one that that created some gaps and some fissures between me and a lot of the African American friends that I had that I think have since been resolved. But there was a time during the 1988 campaign when I had to I just grew weary sometimes of having to defend constantly beliefs in which I strongly believed. So Willie Horton, I think, more than anything, that whole thing kind of created some gaps that were uncomfortable at times, but they were surmountable.
How did you defend the Willie Horton campaign?
Well, a couple of ways. One is that a lot of my African-American friends were the charge that they made was that his face and his color should never have been a part of the campaign. I mean, it should never have been a part of the message that we were conveying. And my response to them was that it wasn't. All of the campaign, the official George Bush for President political campaign ads never once referred to the color of his skin. They referred, as they should have referred, to the atrocity of his crimes and pointed more towards Dukakis's lenient furlough program, which was the focus of our whole, that was what we were pointing to, much more than the color of his skin. That was never an issue. It was never a part of what we were doing. The campaign ads, or the ads that were produced that showed his skin and referred to the color of him, was completely done by an independent outfit.
You tried to bring a degree of racial sensitivity to the speeches that the president was given. And there was one speech that you were editing in which the word, and I'll use the word nigger was used. And you told the president he really ought to take that word out. Would you tell us the context it was to be used in and why you felt that it should be excised?
Sure. And it's an important context. Bush was referring in the speech to the time when he was running for Congress in Texas, where he was a full supporter of a Fair Housing Act, which would in many ways benefit the black population there. And he was referring to the political backlash that he received from many of his constituents for supporting that Fair Housing Act. And I think the words he used were, that many of his white colleagues weren't interested in having the niggers helped or something like that. I do need to get that language exactly right, but that was a context. He was not, he was using that word, but he was also using it to paint a picture that that kind of bigotry was unacceptable in his mind. So he went in with a positive message, yet he was using a very negative word to convey that message. And my response, I just kind of jotted down on the margin of the speech that that word is vile, that it should not be used in any context, and just kind of sent it back to the speechwriter. And we had he came down to my office immediately, and we sat down and had a conversation about it, and he asked me the same question that you just asked. Even considering the context that Bush is using this word, isn't it still okay to use it? He's not condoning the use of the word. He's saying that these words should not be used, that these beliefs should not be accepted. And I tried mightily to try to explain to the speechwriter that, again, it doesn't matter about the context. I think that these folks don't want to hear him utter the word, that it's deeper than that, and that it's, that we've gotten way beyond that, that our struggles, we struggled through that back in the 60s, and we struggled through that back in the 70s, and we don't need to hear, that kind of language in any context. But anyway, to make a long story short, the speechwriter did take some of those edits back to the vice president, and I went with Bush to the speech that night, still not having talked directly with him, but as I was standing in the wings, listening to his speech, just butterflies fluttering about in my stomach, wondering, well, is he going to say it or is he not going to say it? To my surprise and to my prideful enjoyment, he had taken everything out.
One of the press briefings that you set up with the president was with magazine publishers,
mm-hmm.
and Christy Hefner from Playboy was on the list. And much to your surprise, the president was furious,
mm-hmm.
just furious that someone from Playboy should be invited into the White House. What was his problem?
Well, this was the maddest that I've ever seen him, and I did not see him mad often, but it was not a pleasant experience. I walked into the Oval late. Bush was red-faced and just, livid might be a little too strong a word, but he was pretty upset. And I still had not had a chance really to gauge what was upsetting him. There was a couple of other people in the Oval Office, 6 or 7 of his aides were also there. And I walked in and he immediately turned and said, "Kristen, maybe you can explain this mess." And I thought, he's using a word like mess, and he doesn't use words like mess very often. Something is seriously wrong here. And anyway, so he said to me, "Well, I don't know if you realize this or not, but this is my home. It's not just a place where you come to work every day. This is my home, and I'm looking at this list here, and your guest list has Playboy magazine on it." He was concerned, as he always is, about infringing on or impugning his integrity and his character. And he saw that as being something that was, that crossed the line. Having Playboy into the White House, he thought, was damaging to his integrity, that he didn't think it was the right thing, that he thought that we should have perhaps censored the list more carefully.
Mm-hmm. Kristen Clark Taylor is my guest, and she served as White House Director of Media Relations under President Bush. By the time of the 92 convention, you were in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how you felt about some of the family values discussions during the convention. I mean, I think the message that the Republicans were putting out during the convention was that family values meant that women should have children and stay home and raise them. And here you were, a mother with one young son at home and another child on the way, and you were working up until the last minute.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think more than that, though, I think that the family values that the Republican Party was, that part of their belief, as it is part of mine, is that family values, whether the woman is working at home or whether they're working in the home, are things that should be carried over in everything that we do. I don't think that the that the workplace specifically was, that wasn't tied to what I believe are family values. I think teaching children and giving them moral compasses is my idea of what a sound moral family value is.
I want to get back to working in the White House again.
Mm-hmm.
You're right that when you were working in the White House at, you know, official dinner functions, you were served mostly by older African-American men, and that made you very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what made you uncomfortable about it, and if you ever kind of spoke to them about it, or whether that would have seemed inappropriate and awkward.
I was brought up not being served by old, dignified black men. I was taught to serve them, to respect my elders, and it just felt uncomfortable having them wipe away my crumbs and mop up my gravy spills. It just felt as though something was out of kilter. It was the respect that I have learned to have for the elderly in my life, for particularly for the black men and women in my life, that just didn't feel right. It just felt unbalanced. But there came a moment at one luncheon in the state dining room where I realized, it wasn't quite a revelation, but it was close to it, where I realized that I am blessed by being, I was blessed by being able to sit there in that dining room with the president sitting directly across from me under the portrait of Abraham Lincoln and just being well respected by my peers and by the president and pregnant with my second child, and there was so much positive in my life, and that these men who were serving me saw their own situations as positive. They too felt the same amount of pride in what they did. And that it was actually might have been condescending for me to feel ashamed about them having to serve me. So it was just kind of trying to balance both worlds. And I think in the end that I was able to strike that balance.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
My guest has been Kristen Clark Taylor, author of the new book, The First to Speak, A Woman of Color Inside the White House. And she served as the White House Director of Media Relations under President Bush. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up later on All Things Considered. Ted Clark reports from Washington that the Clinton administration is finding out that one of the most vexing aspects of the aftermath of the raid on Iraq is that Iraq continues to be a threat. Also, a report on floodwaters from the Mississippi, which have shut down more than 600 miles of the river to commercial traffic and could keep it closed for several weeks. And a report on the Haiti talks in New York, where diplomats are struggling to keep the talks on restoring democracy to Haiti from collapsing. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. German improviser and guitarist Hans Reischel is also an inventor of odd musical instruments, like an 11-string guitar with three pickups, or an elongated guitar with a neck sticking off to the right as well as the left. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Reischel's most amazing instrument is the daxophone, which Kevin describes as an amplified piece of wood.
Hans Reischel takes a small wooden plank about a foot long and saws a fat curved notch or hole out of one end. The other end is clamped to a stand, and he amplifies the wood using a contact microphone. Inside that notch, he bows the wood with a violin bow. With his other hand, he rocks a small curved block of wood along the back of the plank. That changes its tuning, like fretting a guitar string, although the Dax itself has no strings. The size, shape, and variety of wood also affect the sound. This is what several overdubbed daxophones sound like. This music is from Reichel's CD, Shanghaied on Tor Road, billed as the world's first operetta performed on nothing but the daxophone. It's on the great German label, FMP. The daxophone is a cute gimmick, but Reichel doesn't settle for that. He searches for a musical style the dax lends itself to. Like Michelangelo looking for the person inside a block of marble, Reichel finds the music inside the wood. Some of Reichel's stuff resembles old Memphis jug band music. That makes sense. When you're dealing with makeshift instruments of indefinite pitch, rhythm becomes the most important thing. It's the one parameter you totally control. Even so, it's interesting that this European improviser slides so naturally into African-American syncopation, blues tonality, and blues vocalizations. His homemade music can sound a little like the electric Miles Davis of the 1970s, too. Some American jazz watchdogs and some continental players will tell you European improvised music has nothing to do with jazz. But the rhythms of jazz and the moan of the blues have gotten under the skin of every music in the world that's susceptible to change, which is to say, any music that's alive, even when a musician starts from scratch.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Shanghaied on Tor Road on the FMP label, distributed by North Country. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Nancy Greenlees. Many thanks and congratulations to our top-notch research assistant, Penny Nelson. She's leaving Fresh Air to produce the talk show Radio Times at WHYY. We know she'll do a great job. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This summer's movie sleeper is What's Love Got to Do With It, the Tina Turner story. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Angela Bassett, who plays Turner in the film. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.